BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to the Saturday the 14th edition of Dialect. Well, the snow has disappeared and a little bit of sunshine has come out in recent days. We're going to be speaking to Mohamed El Haddad, who is a Libyan-British parent of three children, who is going to be driving all the way to Palestine in order to deliver aid. We're also going to be re-examining the legacy of Princess Diana and her death. It was just over about 6 months ago, the inquest result came through, and there are still many questions to be answered. So in the coming weeks, we're going to be looking at that. We've also got another instalment of the history of the Mafia, as read by Malcolm Grieve, the actor, and the What's On Guide, courtesy of Jeff Sparks, and music besides. In the studio right now, I have Mohamed El Haddad. Welcome.
Hi, assalamu alaikum. This is an Islamic greeting to everybody. Thank you so much for inviting me to this brief conversation about the trip I'm taking to Gaza.
Well, you're more than welcome, because you're going to drive over 5,000 miles to Gaza. When did you first decide you were going to do this?
That was just about 10 days, basically. I've heard about the convoy going from London to Gaza. That was extremely... a big mission for me to join it, to be honest. And then I've decided to contact those people, and I've got in touch with the organizers. This convoy has been, organized by Viva Palestine, and, the leader of the convoy is George Galloway, the MB.
Okay, so you're a project manager of the UK Arabic Society. You've got a master's degree in finance. You're doing a PhD at Bristol University. And you've got three children, so you've got a lot of responsibility behind.
Yes, and that's why I'm having them now with me here, because I have nobody to look after them at home at this time, as the mom is working, and we've got so many other commitments to do. So, I've decided to go through this mission, although lots of responsibilities I'm doing. But this is the least I can do, to be honest, Tony.
When you first found out about it, was that through watching TV, I imagine? What was your first gut reaction about Israel and what they're doing in Palestine at the moment?
I was back home in Libya for the Christmas holiday to see my parents. I was really shocked when I've seen the photos. And it was a limited images, although not really the truth we have seen. But, that really affected my, feeling towards that. And emotionally, I was really affected. But, adding to that, basically, the Libyan government, reacted very, very strongly.
Okay.
Starting from the prime minister, which is the Colonel Gaddafi, and all the government, the people in the streets, they are fighting for that, and they supported the Palestine, people, as well as, schools being, stopped, the traffic's been stopped for a while, the black flag's been, put on. Loads of other, activities being put up, but they cannot decide on Israel to stop the war or to suspend the fire or whatever. Cannot do it.
It's interesting in this country to hear such a strong reaction. I can't imagine quite such a vehement reaction occurring here, even though people may be very upset about it. Is that what sense of affiliation do you share with people in Gaza and
right.
Palestine?
Basically, why people are not really acting here in probably Britain or the public, because they probably do know nothing about the situation there in Gaza.
I can believe that, yeah.
If you see the BBC, at some stage they refused to broadcast a fundraising project to fund some raise for those people back in Gaza. That was one of the things that we have already seen, and they clearly rejected to do this effort. This is a charitable work. Why do they rejected to take this opportunity and help people to, you know, to be alive. This is the foundation. This is the fundamental, you know, requirement of the life, is to get just food and, you know, just be in the right place to eat and alive.
No, well, there are a lot of complicated politics in it, though, I suppose. I mean, the BBC said they wish to remain impartial. How do you feel, sort of morally, introducing sort of politics into it, that the situation stands with Palestine and Israel, from your perception?
I really don't want to go that far in our conversation, because I'm not a politician, but this war has been running for 50 years.
Okay.
None of the leaders have, you know, managed to conclude this this war and make people live in a peace. But as an ordinary person, you know, believe in human rights, at least my least effort I can do towards those people is to get them the aids and the medicine they needed.
Okay. What are you going to be taking with you then on your journey?
Right. My effort is to deliver whatever I managed to collect from Bristol area. Unfortunately, I'm the only person who's, you know, presenting the Southwest, or Bristol in particular. You know, we managed to collect some medicine, some financial support to those people, some clothes to the children, particularly in this winter. Mm-hmm. And also I managed to collect some, you know, sort of library material to the children to learn how to speak English. Although it's not really, you know, the mission of them at the moment, but it might help them at some stage. The convoy, you know, have got a worth of £1 million worth of, you know, medicine and, you know, first aids and clothes, blankets, you know, tents, sleeping bags, all these, you know, necessities.
What route are you going to take to get there? Are you going across Europe or across Africa?
Yes, we're going to be leaving from London on 14th, which is Saturday, 14th of February, about 11 o'clock. To France, then to Spain, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, and then hopefully, inshallah, to Rafah. From Rafah to Gaza.
And that's about, how many miles is that? About 5,000 odd miles?
That's about 4,726 miles.
How long is it going to take you to get there?
This is the estimation, which is going to take about 3 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is the UK Arabic Society? And how
it is like a recent established organization. It's only been running for about 3 years. We've got some sort of activities like a supplementary school to teach the children Arabic language, to keep their identity, to link them with their culture, to support them within the mainstream schools, to assess the English needs as well as the maths, particularly for those new arrivals like the Somalian community. Mm. They really need, you know, a sort of guidance or foundations to follow, and they found it with this you know, supplementary school. We're running this supplementary school for the third year this year at May Park Primary School. We also got some other activities like the youth project for young brothers and young sisters. Those two projects are completely different from each other, particularly when you come to the teenager stage from 13 till 19 years old.
Yeah.
So we give them the chance where they can talk to each other, they can be, you know, alone, away from their parents, away from their friends and whoever, and become like only girls or boys in their environments. As well as one of the projects we run, as well as the women group, the UK Arabic Society women group, the Arab women group, they have their own activities as well. And we also have like a men's club, where they can, you know, work and play together, have sports, have fun chatting, you know.
Are they, what is their, were they interested in this mission to Palestine as well? Are they involved in that?
Who yes, definitely. Everybody is involved. And basically one of the arrangements we have made is that we've managed to get some sort of assessment from an organization in Libya, a charitable organization in Libya called Al-Gaddafi, a charitable organization to assist the convoy while in Libya. Mm-hmm. Those people have provided us with free fuel, free transportation within the Libyan borders, accommodation, food, everything will be available for us for free. So this convoy will not pay any single penny within the Libyan barriers.
Do you feel you are?
So we've got two people from the UK Arabic Society are going by flight to Libya on 18th. Mr. Jamal Sheikhi is the chairman of the organization, and also one of the directors, Abdul Hakim Bayou. Those two people are from the board of UK Arabic Society. They're flying on 18th to Libya to arrange and facilitate and smooth the way the convoy will be dealing with the Libyan government.
When you're arriving in Palestine, I mean, obviously Israel is very hostile. How dangerous is it there right now? Are you? Do you feel your life might be in danger when you arrive in Palestine?
Let's first hope that we get through the port of Rafah to Gaza. But this is our hope, is that we manage to get through. So all the medicine, all the material we have, all the financial assistance will be delivered to the needy people. This is our mission. But we really don't care about ourselves. I'm sure that, all my people in the convoy, all people in the convoy are sharing my view in terms of they don't care about themselves as much as they do care about the material we are delivering to the needy people back in Palestine.
Are you expecting trouble in any of the borders in particular on your route there?
Yes, at the moment we haven't confirmed the visas for two countries. There is two countries have not yet provided us with the visa.
Right.
Apart from those two countries, everything I think is going to be all right, apart from also Rafah. Rafah could be a problem for us, and we're anticipating 2 or 3 days in the port.
Okay, where is Rafah?
Rafah is the place where we... It's a good question, by the way. People probably don't know about it.
I don't know where it is.
Sorry, but most people know that this is the barriers from Egypt to Palestine. This is the only way to get through to Gaza or to Palestine through Egypt.
What is Egypt's sort of position on this conflict? Do you think you'll have any problems going through Egypt? Or
also back to the political issues, I'm not really willing to to contribute to this type of questions, but we hope that they are not going to raise any problems to the convoy.
So the emphasis entirely is that this is purely a charitable aid in humanitarian interests, and there's no political bias involved?
I'm aware I'm off, but probably other people have their own interests. But my mission is to provide and, deliver the equipment, money, assistance to those people.
What are you going to do if you can't get your aid in? What?
Right, this is the plan of the organizer. Yes, it's quite sort of gambling, yeah. But the organizer have already told us that if, let's say that we are not, able to get it through, then there is a charitable organization there. They're going to, deal with this issue and we go back.
Right.
This is the plan of the organizer. We are just part of it. We have to listen and obey the orders.
So how many of you are there that are going to be going en route?
Over 100 vehicle and about 320 driver and passengers.
Okay. Have you got any sort of security convoy or anything going with you, or are you just sort of going en masse in sort of...
The plan is, there is three people on charge of this convoy. George Galloway is the first one.
He's going as well.
Yes, he is going to be one of the one part of this convoy. Sabah Al Mukhtar, and then Kevin. Those three people are the leaders now.
Okay.
And then we got it's like instruction, management instruction. Under those three people, there is 4 people, and then 10 people. The 10 people are the team leaders. The other 4 are the link between the 3 and the 10.
Okay.
Right? So it's like divided in two groups.
So like a sort of little army. There's lots of hierarchy.
Exactly. Hierarchy instructions. That's right, yes.
Okay. If you do have to go all the way back, are you going to drive all the way back or fly?
I'm planning to go back to Libya to see my parents and then from Libya back to England.
Okay. So you've got a kind of halfway stopping point, I guess, if you've got family in Libya.
While I'm going to Gaza, we are not able to stop. I have to be with the convoy.
Yeah.
But when I come back, then everybody will fly back to England, and possibly a couple of vehicles are coming back by the vehicles as well. Some people are coming back by the vehicles to England.
Okay, well, we're going to be following your story in the coming weeks to sort of find out what's going on whilst you're there and how you felt it went when you got back. But looking forward, what is your best hope for what can happen in Gaza? What do you hope will kind of happen?
My best hope is to deliver the equipment we have and the financial assistance to those people, because they are really in need. Imagine those people have not got any, you know, facilities to cook, to eat, even to sleep or to do anything. All the, you know, schools, colleges, university is being destroyed. Even the mosques. This is religions, you know, venues. They should not be even touched. The education departments is being destroyed as well. Mm. We're not going to talk about the other political offices. But this is the most important thing, that if you destroy university, school, college, that means this generation is not going to be educated. Then you destroy the whole country.
And if you could say something to the BBC, who have refused to show an appeal advert, what would you say to them?
To be honest, they have already been told that they were wrong. And they probably knew now they were wrong. But they may not be able to say the truth. And they, you know, review their decision and accept the fact that other channels have done it. So why don't you do it? This is the thing that I'm expecting from you, from them. But I'm not really, hoping that we're going to have any other activities there with it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mohammed, for coming in. And we all genuinely wish you the very best of luck on your over 4,000-mile journey across Beijing, North Africa.
Thank you for your hospitality. The only thing I just probably need to mention, that we have raised a very good amount of money. We have raised, a big number of medicine delivered to us. We really highly appreciate the efforts that's being done by those people. Some people have donated, a person have donated a car, and he does not want his name to be shown, a car worth about £13,000, which is the one I'm taking. And this is really something that we cannot just say thank you about it. It's over that. We have to understand that those people really appreciating and understanding what's going on there in Gaza. And I hope everybody should learn about Gaza and what's going on for the last 50 years. Back in Gaza. So if you spend just 10 or 5 minutes searching about Gaza and learning about what's there in Palestine, what's between Israel and Palestine, that would be wonderful. You will learn a lot. And thank you so much for your time as well.
You're very welcome. If you want to find out more about the Palestinian situation, you can go to www.vivapalestina.org. Or indeed, I'm sure if you just stick the word Palestine in Google, you will come up with plenty of information. Can I just ask lastly, can people contribute financially?
Yes, we got at the moment we plan to take £3,000 in cash to cover the cost of delivering this material to Gaza, but the fundraising will continue up to 5th of March.
Right.
Where I supposed to be in Egypt. This money will be transferred to me there in Egypt to purchase some extra, material related to the health and safety of those people there in Gaza.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the cheapest place to buy medicine from,
okay,
which is Egypt. So the fundraising is continue. Just go to Viva Palestine and you can donate whatever you want to donate online.
Excellent.
Is available.
Okay. If you're listening to this online and you haven't yet got to the 13th of February, which is Friday, it's worth me reading this out. Bristol joins Lifeline to Gaza. You can give Mohammed a wave off on Friday the 13th at 2:30 p.m.
Do you want to say something?
No.
you're leaving from St. Mark's Road Mosque in Easton. And a contingent of vehicles will gather there to join the Viva Palestina Lifeline, and then you're going off to London, where on Saturday you are leaving it in the morning.
Yes.
Okay. If you want to find out more, vivapalestina.org, and I've got a number here as well, 07766 432 413, or you can contact Joe at Benefield, which is benefield.force, and the number 9.co.uk.
Joe is a very, very hard worker lady.
Yeah?
She marvelous. She's marvelous. She's, you know, I haven't seen a lady like her before. She's really very supportive to this mission. Thank you so much, Joe.
You've had a shout out, Joe. Excellent.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's time for some music now, just to take a break. So this is from a CD called It's the 70s. This is Third World, and the track is Now That We Found Love. Well, that was a track by 70s band Third World. We're moving on now to Princess Diana. It was 12 years ago, of course, since she died in that crash. And the inquest result that was finished last autumn, that we heard the results of, was presumably supposed to complete the issue and lay everything to rest. And I think everybody really knew that probably wasn't going to be the case, because it still left many, many questions. And some people, a lot of people in fact, are more convinced than ever that something dodgy still went on. That being a very vague, loose terminology. So by way of introduction to the topic, because we're going to be featuring stuff about Princess Diana over the next month or so, this is a handy introduction to the topic from a Discovery Channel documentary, which introduces the topic of what questions are still unanswered.
The paparazzi arrested at the crash claimed that they could not keep up with the Mercedes and were nowhere near when it passed into the tunnel.
Is it possible that the motorbike and white Fiat Uno only looked like frenzied paparazzi pursuing the Mercedes, but were really agents with an entirely different purpose? When former MI6 agent Richard Tomlinson heard about the Alma Tunnel crash, it seemed eerily similar to an MI6 plot he had seen earlier designed to assassinate a political leader.
I saw a plan to assassinate Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic. It's virtually identical to what happened in the Alma Tunnel. It proposed using a powerful laser strobe to disorient Milosevic's driver as he went into a road tunnel in Geneva. A tunnel is a perfect place for an assassination because there are fewer witnesses. The Alma Tunnel is also ideal because there are no crash rails along the central pillars, so it's a death trap.
For 2 weeks, the French authorities dismissed the idea that a second car was involved in the crash. Then finally, they admitted to finding a mysterious scratch on the Mercedes that contained paint fragments and bumper material identified as coming from a white Fiat Uno.
It was our investigators, not the French police, who found the Fiat Uno. It was found in a garage in Paris and traced to a paparazzi named James Anderson. Anderson was an Anglophile with close connections to the British. According to Anderson, he was in Paris at the time of the crash, but for some unexplained reason, decided to get up at 3:30 a.m., 2 hours after the crash, and board a flight to Corsica from Orly Airport in Paris. The French police and the magistrate accepted an alibi based on a simple gas receipt from Anderson, albeit that the paint and bumper samples from the white Fiat Uno matched those left on the Mercedes.
3 years later, the Anderson story took an unexpected and sinister turn.
On the 5th of May 2000, Philip Anderson was found burned to death in his car. The car was locked. He could only be identified from dental records. The French officials claimed that this was suicide, but it's not a suicide known to this world.
Just a month before the crash, the Chicago Tribune had reported that Diana told reporters from the Al Fayed yacht,
"You are going to get a big surprise with the next thing I do."
The reason Dodi and Diana arrived to Paris on the 30th of August to pick their engagement ring.
Security camera video footage taken by the Ritz Hotel clearly shows Dodi, accompanied by his bodyguard, Trevor Rees-Jones, going to the Repossi Jewelers opposite the Ritz, where he picked up the engagement ring for Princess Diana. This should put to rest claims by the British establishment press that the engagement was a sham. It should also put to rest the claims in the book supposedly written by Trevor Rees-Jones that there was no engagement. I do believe that this book was not written by him, but by the security services.
Meanwhile, back at Buckingham Palace, how was the royal family responding to Diana's rapidly developing relationship with Dodi Al-Fayed?
Prince Philip was openly opposed to the relationship between Princess Diana and Dodi, who he described as an oily bedhopper.
Prince Philip will never have allowed my son, as an Egyptian, naturally tanned, would be the stepfather of Prince William and the future king.
And what were the links between MI6, the royal household, and American intelligence agencies?
MI6 is routinely asked by the royal household to provide intelligence on potential threats to members of the royal family. This service would frequently extend to asking friendly intelligence services, such as the CIA, to place members of the royal family under discreet surveillance, ostensibly for their own protection. MI6 documents reveal vital information about the surveillance of Princess Diana in the days leading up to her death.
Did Diana herself feel threatened by the royal family and the British secret services? One of Diana's former love interests, James Hewitt, believes that Diana feared for her life. And according to Hewitt, he was himself threatened during their relationship. And Diana confided her fear of the royals to Mohammed Al-Fayed.
And always she expecting that something going to happen to her one day. She fly in a helicopter and they will... If a helicopter will be blown up or anything, you know, because all the time she is suspicious that the palace would not let her survive.
But is there proof that both British MI6 and American intelligence agencies were conducting full-blown surveillances of Diana and Dodi in their final months and days? Is there anything that would add credence to Al-Fayed's accusations?
We've learned that Richard Spearman, the chief of staff to the director of MI6, the late Sir David Spedding, and Nicholas Langman, a senior MI6 agent, were at the British Embassy in Paris immediately prior to and after the crash.
We've confirmed the NSA has more than 1,000 pages of documents in its possession. The CIA and the FBI have also confirmed they have records. We've initiated litigation against the government, but so far it's blocked every effort we've made to try and gain access to this information.
The trail of evidence appears to lead to people and top-secret documents of both British and American intelligence services. And recent testimony reveals that Diana spoke freely of her fears for her life at the hands of the British Secret Services, MI6 and MI5. She is reported to have stated publicly,
"Someday, I shall go up in a helicopter, and it'll just blow up. MI5 will do away with me."
The evidence and facts which I know, for example, the plan to assassinate Slobodan Milosevic, the fact that Henri Paul was a paid informer for MI6, all of these facts point to me very strongly that this crash was engineered and that it was an assassination, a murder.
Some questions about how, what, or who killed Princess Di will likely never be answered to everyone's satisfaction. But sooner or later, the world will discover who killed Princess Di.
That was an excerpt from a Discovery Channel documentary about Princess Diana. The interview with Martin Bashir, that was part of the Panorama series that was broadcast in 1995, has never been rebroadcast since then. So to follow on with the theme of Princess Diana, in following weeks, in the next two or three, we're going to be rebroadcasting sections of that interview for you to listen to.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now, and I do feel somewhat incongruous saying this, this is I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing by the New Seekers.
I'd like to build the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtle doves. I'd like to teach the world to sing. Echo through the hills for a blue.
That was the New Seekers. I think a word with the Daleks director of music coming on, because that was somewhat of an odd choice, perhaps. Coming up next, we've got The History of the Mafia, read by the actor Malcolm Grieve.
The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. The decades since Al Capone's death in 1947 had done nothing to diminish his reputation as the most notorious American mob boss of all time and the embodiment of the rise of organized crime during Prohibition. Without doubt, he is the most infamous Italian-American gangster and member of the Mafia to have his blood-soaked name become part of both underworld folklore and US history. Except, of course, Al Capone was never an orthodox member of the Mafia, and his mob, known as the Chicago Outfit and later just the Outfit, never started out as a traditional Mafia crime family. In fact, much of Capone's eventful career in organized crime saw him battling against elements of what would later be accepted as the American Mafia. Although he had gone to school with and been a member of the Five Points Gang with Lucky Luciano and other Sicilians, Capone's Neapolitan heritage prevented him from being accepted into the organized crime gangs in America that had links with the Sicilian Mafia. Instead, he chose to go his own way. His reluctance to be a part of an established Italian-American crime group did not prevent Capone's rise to power within the underworld. His links to John Torrio, forged during his time as a member of the Five Points, got him his first job as a bouncer and enforcer in Brooklyn, and later led to Torrio bringing him into his Chicago operations. Amongst the rivals that Capone had to battle with for supremacy over Chicago crime when he took control of Torrio's Southside vice, gambling and illegal drink operations were the terrible Jennas. This is a group of Sicilian brothers who dominated Chicago's Little Italy. They were originally black-hand extortionists before getting into bootlegging, and had recruited an army of soldiers from their own village of Marsala. They were also the Chicago heads of the Unione Siciliana, a Sicilian-American political organization that had become the nationwide front for the growing network of Sicilian mafia syndicates. After Capone had brothers Mike and Tony the Gentleman Jenner killed in 1925, he tried to have one of his own men, Antonio Lombardo, who was a Sicilian, appointed as the new president of the Chicago Unione Siciliana. This led Capone's Chicago outfit into a bloody war with the city's last powerful Sicilian mafia group, headed by Joseph Aiello, the former Jenner ally. Aiello killed Lombardo and his Capone-backed successor Pasquale Loaldo. He also tried to bribe Capone's favourite chef to poison him. Despite the $35,000 on offer, the chef told Capone what Aiello was planning, which led to Capone declaring that Aiello was going to get it real good. Capone won the war against the Sicilian element in Chicago, which meant that when Salvatore Maranzano declared the creation of Cosa Nostra in 1931, he had to recognize Capone's Chicago outfit as a separate family within the Cosa Nostra, despite its non-mafia origins. Capone's outfit had always been multicultural, his most trusted man being the Moscow-born Jew Jake Greasy Thumb Gutzik, and Capone was happy to take anyone under his wing, regardless of religion, nationality or race, as long as they made money and did as he said. Even after Capone's fall from power due to encroaching syphilis and his imprisonment on Alcatraz, the outfit retained its freedom from much traditional mafia rule and ritual. After the end of Prohibition, the outfit moved heavily into loan sharking, extortion, labour racketeering, and attempting to shake down Hollywood movie studios, a move outside of Chicago that would see both Nitti and Ricca facing prison time. Even post-1957, when Sam Momo Giancana took over the leadership of the outfit and moved it into a more mainstream position in the American mafia setup, it still bore some of the character of Capone's cross-cultural approach. The problem that Capone encountered and successfully dealt with in Chicago was the growing power of Italian-American organized crime groups with Sicilian roots. It was symptomatic of a growing criminal network that was spreading its power across America. The Black Hand extortionists, who had been members of Sicilian mafia groups before arriving in America, had begun to organize themselves along mafia lines in the New World. Although originally few in number, their structure, traditions, unifying code of criminal ethics and rules soon gave them an edge over the established criminal networks that were beginning to fragment. Although they faced opposition from similar groups to themselves, the Sicilian gangs soon made their presence felt outside of Italian enclaves and the old Black Hand racket. Not only were they becoming major players in prostitution and gambling, They were even going up against the established Irish crime gangs for control of the docks and union rackets all across the eastern seaboard. Using the front of the Unione Siciliani, a fraternal society originally designed to provide support and insurance for Sicilian immigrants, the groups developed a loose-knit nationwide network of Sicilian crime gangs. When prohibition came into effect in 1920, Sicilian organized crime groups were often in the strongest position to exploit the massive new opportunity that arose from the illicit alcohol business. The Sicilian-American mafia families enjoyed an incredible boom in profits throughout the Roaring Twenties. In many areas, especially New York, it was clear that they were now the strongest force in organized crime. Their remarkable rise in prosperity did not go unnoticed back in Sicily. The most powerful Sicilian mafia boss on the island, Vito Cascioferro, or Don Vito, had dreams of gaining control of all the groups in America and organizing them into one all-powerful crime family with himself as the boss of bosses. When Don Vito was imprisoned by Mussolini's fascists, his plan was taken over by one of his lieutenants, Salvatore Maranzano. Arriving in New York in 1927, Maranzano set out to take over the Sicilian-American operation that was booming under Giuseppe Joe the Boss Masseria. Maranzano reasoned that if he controlled New York's Sicilian-American mafia, he could also control those across the rest of the country. Maranzano recruited an army of mafiosi around himself from his own hometown of Castellammare del Golfo in Sicily, and was soon muscling in on Joe the Boss's rackets. By 1928, Maranzano had so many supporters that Masseria was forced to go to war with him. Between 1928 and 1930, the bloody conflict that would become known after September the 10th, 1930, as the Castellammarese War, had claimed more than 50 lives. Masseria's underboss, Lucky Luciano, saw the way it was going, and brought the war to a swift end by arranging to have Masseria killed while he was playing poker with him at a Coney Island restaurant on April the 15th, 1931. Maranzano declared the war to be over, made Luciano his second in command, and called an extraordinary meeting of more than 500 gangsters from across the country to outline his plan. The mafia in New York would be divided into five families, each with its own boss, underboss, lieutenants, and soldiers, all reporting to the Capo di Tutti Capi, the boss of bosses, which was to be Maranzano. The new organization was called Cosa Nostra, meaning Our Thing, and was intended to bring peace and profits to all. Secretly, Maranzano was planning to ensure this peace, and that he stayed the boss of bosses, by killing Luciano and his younger generation of gangster cohorts, including Frank Costello, Vito Genovese, Joe Adonis, and Dutch Schultz. He also planned to kill the fat bastard in Chicago, Al Capone. He hired Irish gangster and hitman Vincent Mad Dog Cole to kill Luciano and paid him $25,000 up front. The plan was for Maranzano to call Genovese and Luciano to a meeting at which Cole was to turn up and gun them down. However, before this could happen, Luciano arranged for four Jewish gunmen to burst into Maranzano's office and shoot him instead. Maranzano's reign as the one and only boss of bosses had lasted less than 4 months. Cole turned up as Maranzano's killers were rushing from the murder scene, a situation that left him $25,000 up without even having to shoot anyone.
Thank you very much to the actor Malcolm Grieve, and we'll have more of the history of Mafia next week. Now, here's the Pink Panther theme by Henry Mancini. I felt like I was in a lift for the majority of that track. Well, here he comes, slinking into the studio, waving his long pigtail at me coquettishly. Thor's leather-clad representative on Earth, complete with blonde highlights, the What's On Guide man, Jess Barks. What's on?
Thank you, John. Good evening, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 19th of February, and at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol, the Communicators will be performing with support from the Minnesota Twins and also the Pin-Ups. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Moving on to Friday, 20th of February, and at the Crown, which is at St. Nicholas Market in Bristol, the Masonics will be performing with support from Bucky. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I bring to you an exclusive. The album is titled Heavy Metal Killers and will be released on February the 16th via Earache Records. This is a track from that album, and it's A Sea of Dead Dreams by Crown and Glory. That was Crown in Glory with A Sea of Dead Dreams from the album Heavy Metal Killers, which is released on February 16th. For more information on Crown in Glory, you can check out www.myspace.com/Crown in Glory. On to Saturday 21st of February, and at Fiddler's in Bristol, the Polecats will be performing with support from Zen Hussies and the Graveyard Johnnies. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £11 in advance. Keeping with Saturday 21st and at Area 81 in Bristol, Neville Staple will be performing with support from Johnny Action Finger and also Smoke Like a Fish. Doors open at 9 p.m. and tickets are £11 in advance and £12 on the door. Finally, on to Sunday 22nd of February, and at the Mission Theatre in Bath, Stackridge will be performing. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £15 each and £14 for concessions. Also on 22nd of February, and at the Tobacco Factory in Bristol, Flash Harry Trio will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I would just like to take the chance to reiterate, Bucky are playing. Bucky are amazing. So get yourself down to the Crown on February 20th.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
This is Bachman Turner Overdrive with You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet.
She said I've had it coming to me, but I'm wondering if that's
Smashy and Nicey, anybody? Anybody remember that? That was written and produced, that track, by Randolph Charles Bachman, don't you know? And that was Bachman Turner Overdrive. That's the end of this week's Dialect Radio Show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based here and right in the city centre, right by Queen Square. Our features today were brought to us by Tony Gosling. Malcolm Grieve read another instalment of The History of the Mafia, to be continued next week. What's On was presented by Jeff Sparks, and thank you very much to Mohammed El Haddad for coming in today to talk to us about his journey to Palestine. Just to remind you of a few essentials, if you want to check out more, go to www.vivapalestina.org. You can email joe@benefield.force9.co.uk, Benefield being B-E-N-E, field. Or you can call 07766-432-413. And as ever, if you want to just sort of educate yourself a little bit about what's going on, I'm sure if you stick Palestine in, 50 million pages of stuff will come up. There's lots going on. And very best wishes to him. Phyllis Tripticura was the studio engineer, and this week's show was produced by Tony Gosling. You can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk, where you can hear us on BCFM 93.2, and a shout out to Preston. Goodbye from here all at Dialect Radio. Take care. Bye-bye.